Hello, everyone. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 136 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Retired, Not Forgotten, Jim Root Disease Cook. Two, the second part of my interview with the scientist who served for 37 years as a plant pathologist with the Agricultural Research Service based on the WSU campus and 2 years as WSU's interim dean of the College of Agriculture, Human, and Natural Resource Sciences. Cook, who retired in 2005, was always good at explaining things. In fact, one of the secrets of his research was the passion he brought to discussing a rather esoteric field. During my career as a reporter, I covered a lot of different researchers, and most were very good at their jobs. But Cook was in a different category altogether. He was the rare researcher who connected with farmers, sort of like his mentor, Orville Vogel, who we'll talk about ahead. But before we dive into the past to discuss Vogel, I wanted Cook to address an issue very much in the forefront of farmers' thinking today. I asked him his thoughts about the demonization of glyphosate.
Well, I think glyphosate is just possibly the best weed control chemical ever developed. You can buy it off the shelf at Home Depot or Lowe's. It's cleared for home use. I think that, quite frankly, the whole anti-glyphosate movement is an anti-Monsanto movement. So much good science. Tim Pollitz, with a postdoc at Pullman, followed up on some work that glyphosate was supposed to be impacting the soil microbiota. Not true. And he published that, although there's other papers that claim it is true. But not good science. I think glyphosate is getting a total bad rap, to be quite blunt about it. You know, it's been out now for like 40 years, and it's made a huge difference in terms of cropping systems and being able to manage that green bridge. There's some really nasty chemicals that could take its place, like paraquat, which was brought in early on with the no-till system before glyphosate was really cleared for use. The bigger question right now is the resistance that's developing in the weed population to glyphosate, requiring heavier doses. Now, that's a worry. But EPA has come out and verified over and over again glyphosate is not a cancer-causing herb chemical. The claims of the World Health Organization, which is not a legitimate organization in terms of determining risk and so forth, are the ones that said it looks like it might be cancer-causing. And so that has carried through for all the lawsuits and so forth. I just find it, I just think glyphosate's getting a bad rap.
Let's shift gears here a little bit, and you're one of the last individuals that I know anyway that had a direct link to Orville Vogel, and I'd like you to talk about him. I mean, was he a genius, or was he just a fellow who happened to have a knack for doing certain things in agriculture?
Well, I think both, but my recollection of working with Orville, and by the way, it started my first year on the job. And there was an outbreak of Fusarium root rot in near Ritzville on the Walt Jantz farm. And I talked to Orville because it was one of his dwarf wheats. Gaines wheat was hammered by Fusarium. Where did it come from? Is there something vulnerable about Gaines wheat genetically that opens the door for Fusarium crown rot? So Orville put one of his big nurseries in a field that I had identified as loaded with the Fusarium spores. So that was in the fall of 1965. And I'll never forget, Clarence Peterson was his technician. And he said, "We're going to leave at 6 o'clock in the morning. So be there." And I was there. And they had the planter and tractor loaded on this truck, and so I was squeezed in the middle of the cab, and Pete was driving, and Orville was on the other side, and out to the Walt Jantz farm, backed up to the loading dock, take the chains off, back the planter off, across the field, plant the nursery, back onto the truck, back to Pullman by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We did that 4 years. And in that time, we had one experiment, one trial that was successful. It actually had enough disease, and that told me, you know, plant breeding and picking resistance is a long-time process. And the variety that was identified in that effort was Luke, and it had the ability to withstand the Fusarium even under water stress, which was a key factor in why Fusarium was so important, was the water stress. Farmers were fertilizing Gaines wheat for a 100-bushel crop with only 60-bushel water, and that caused the crops to stress. So another experiment I had, back to soil fumigation, my colleague from Mount Vernon would bring his equipment over, and we could fumigate the soil with shanks, injecting it, and then cover the soil with a tarp or just roller seal it. And I had an experiment just a little ways out of Pullman in a farmer's field, where we fumigated and then the farmer seeded his crop over the top of that. And then we'd go out and stake out our plots so we could know what treatment was where. And I took Orville out to see what was happening. And it was spectacular. You could see exactly where the soil was fumigated. The wheat was uniformly tall and plenty of tillers. As opposed to next to it, where it was not fumigated, it looked good until you see what it could look like. And uneven height. And Orville, his eyes came right out of his head, practically. He said, "What did you do here? This is how my wheats are supposed to look. Not like that," and pointed to the check. I said, "Well, we put down 25 gallons of VAPAM per acre and covered the soil with, or sealed the soil as best we could." And with that, he started, and Bertha started, what is called the Wheat Research Fund to deal with soil microbiological limitations to wheat production. And so the Vogel Research Fund started based on Orville having looked at those fumigation plots of mine. And it's since evolved into a much broader-based funding program, the Vogel Research Fund. But it started based on his having seen my fumigated, the results of my soil fumigation study. Now, another thing I would mention is that Orville built my first drill. When I started my program, the only field tools I had were rakes and shovels. And I wanted to take my program to the field. And I needed a drill. And he got a four-row split packer wheel, the 16-inch spacing that was developed for seeding in the low rainfall area, the Zimmerman drill. And he made me a drill, built me a drill in Bill's Welding. I'd go down there and see how he was doing with a cone applicator so we could put a different variety in every however many feet, four rows at a time. And I took that drill into my first studies on no-till because those split packer wheels with the shovel in between the split packer wheels to put in the seed did a great job of bulldozing through stubble and leaving a nice black zone where the seed was placed.
So I know it's been years since Orville Vogel died, and yet some of his equipment that he invented is still being used out in small-scale plots. When you think about Orville, was he a better breeder or was he a better inventor? Which one was it? Which comes first?
Well, I think the equipment had to be there in order to be the breeder that he was. He needed to handle lots and lots of material. And, he even built a harvester, which didn't go very far, but the planters that he developed could put, seed huge nurseries and many nurseries all over the country, from the low rainfall area to the high rainfall area. And plant breeding is all a numbers game. And I think that then fed right back into how he was able to look at lots of material. But he definitely had an eye. And back to that field experiment that I talked about where he said, "What did you do here?" I didn't realize it until Orville looked at my plots. That farmer used a mixture of Dawes and Stevens, which farmers were doing. And Orville could pick out the Dawes and the Stevens, but only in my fumigated plots, because the Stevens didn't survive the winter in the non-fumigated plots, but it did in the fumigated. And I was amazed. Mm. He said, oh, this is a mixture of Dawes and Stevens. And then he pointed out to me how he could tell the difference between the two different varieties mixed in my fumigated plots.
So if there'd never been a Vogel, where would we be?
Wow, that's a good question. Definitely, you know, he was an observer, and I just don't know where we would be. I think eventually, well, of course, Borlaug was breeding wheats, but not for the Pacific Northwest. He was breeding wheats for India, and mainly India, but also Pakistan. I can answer that question. It would be totally conjecture on my part.
Okay. All right.
but we're definitely a long way down, long because of Orbel. And all the recognition he got, he deserved.
So was he a fun man to be around? Was he always serious?
Oh, he was a fun man to be around. Another story I can tell you, after he retired, he would come to my office and he'd say, let's go. I said, I got a field I want you to look at. I don't know what's going on, but I want to go. And he had a little garden trowel in his hand that he used to. And we would get out in the field at the bottom of a slope where it was Pythium. And he would dig these plants up and shake the soil off and then say, now, what's this? What's going on here? Tell me about what root disease is this?
This was when he was retired.
Yes, when he was retired. Well, I kept that trowel, and it's now part of an exhibit in Johnson Hall with the Vogel exhibit. It definitely has seen better days, but it still worked to dig up those little seedlings. But whatever I was doing didn't matter. When he said, let's go, we mm-hmm. went.
Let's talk about the Cook chair. Has the Cook chair provided what you hoped it would when it was established?
Oh, I think so. For one thing, I just want to digress a little bit. The establishment of the Cook chair, and with me appointed to as the first Cook chair, is among my greatest honors. And along with my membership elected to the National Academy of Sciences and winning the Wolf Prize in agriculture, that stacks right up there among them. And I'll always be thankful to the Washington Wheat Commission, now the Washington Grains Commission, for doing that. And that chair was formed in 1997, which was the same year that the Vogel Endowed Professorship was promoted to the Vogel Chair. So we were the same year, but the professorship had already been in place, funded by the Washington Wheat Commission a few years before that. So that gave me funds to work with, and I took the attitude that isn't this just not just funding to support my research. I want to see how much good I can do in helping promote research on a broader scale for the wheat industry. No, it was huge, and what I had envisioned was that having laid the groundwork for what we now understand about the root diseases, can we go the next step? And with modern genomics and genetics and gene editing, start to do what Scott Hulbert has started to do, is looking for resistance in exotic germplasm that can be moved in or understand the genetics of it and do the gene editing in mainstream wheat.
This is your hope for Ian Burke, who was recently appointed as the Cook Chair?
Well, Ian is going to be doing weed science, and the Washington Grains Commission decided they're so concerned about the resistance that's developing to herbicides. And so that will now be the focus of the Cook Chair. Tim Politz is still with ARS at Pullman, and he's working on root diseases. I'm hopeful that the day will come when there will be another position at Pullman to focus entirely on breeding for resistance to root disease, because the foundation is there. It's just waiting to bring the new high tech. And there's such a powerhouse of genetics and genomics research at WSU, thanks in many respects to the Wheat Commission or the Grains Commission and also to ARS that's made huge investments there. So what we need is somebody that knows how to work with root disease And Tim Pollitz is that person right now working with Kim Campbell. But I would certainly hope, I've made the case, there's another 15 to 20% yield potential that's going unrealized, even in spite of how successful we've been in managing the root diseases. But Pythium and Rhizoctonia are still kind of the ones that are waiting to be dealt with genetics.
You know, as a reporter, Jim, back in the day when I was watching WSU more closely as a educational and political organization, suddenly you went from an ARS scientist to a WSU administrator. You were appointed interim dean. I never knew the story as a reporter. How did that transpire?
Well, it was a total surprise to me. I avoided administration all of my career. I had plenty of opportunity to start at the associate level and or go directly in as a dean at one of our major land-grant universities. And I took anywhere from 1 to 3 picoseconds to decide the answer is no. I just loved what I was doing and making good progress, so feeling good about what I was doing. Until Lane Rollins, the then president at WSU, asked me if I would assume the dean's job in replacement for the dean that was in the job at the time. And it took me a little while to think about it, but to be truthful, I enjoyed that job. And I announced on my first day, and I think you quoted this in an article, maybe in the Capital Press, sitting in a room with the department chairs and center directors, I said, I don't want this job, but I'm not going to be a caretaker dean. And that's how I operated. And we made a lot of changes, and we made changes fast. And I had support from the other administrators in the changes we were making.
Jim, what about the stubble burning that was going on early in your career? It's still going on at this point, but perhaps not as much. Is there any advantage to root diseases in terms of burning your field?
Well, just to, why were they burning stubble? Of course, there was a weed control benefit, but it made it easier to seed the field, especially with no-till. But it was believed, widely held in soil science, that the straw left after harvest was toxic. And when you seeded wheat directly into it, like with no-till, and you could see the combine row effect and so forth, that straw was generating toxins as it decomposed on the soil surface. Well, I did an experiment. Actually, I worked on the Charles Keno farm in Spokane County, and I'll just give one example. I asked the question, is the wheat better in burned stubble because of organisms in the straw or organisms in the soil? And the experiment I did using soil fumigation, I laid out, I had Charles Keno burn an area in his stubble, and then I laid out an experiment where I fumigated the soil or left it not fumigated, and I brought in fresh straw and fumigated the straw or left it natural. And then I laid out an experiment in all combinations. I had fumigated soil covered with natural straw, fumigated soil covered with fumigated straw, and non-fumigated soil covered with natural straw and non-fumigated soil. And the results were spectacular. The organisms were in the soil and not in the straw. And when I covered non-fumigated soil with either fumigated or non-fumigated straw, the yields was 75 bushels per acre. I remember this number right in my head. There was 70-some bushels per acre. If I fumigated the soil, it was 95 bushels per acre, whether the straw on the soil was natural or fumigated. And when I had no straw but fumigated soil only, the yield was 108 bushels. This is the yield of 4 replicate plots, and each plot was 8 feet wide and 24 feet long. So the yield potential for that site was 108 bushels per acre. The yield we got with natural soil covered with straw was 75 bushels. There was another 30 bushels to be had with the same water in the ground.
What was happening?
I was knocking. What was happening is but that wet blanket effect. When you cover natural soil with straw, it keeps it cool and wet. And it fits the classic, what in plant pathology is taught, the plant disease triangle. So to have a disease, whether it's rust or foot rot or root disease, you have to have a susceptible crop, a susceptible host. You need to have a virulent pathogen, and you need to have the right environment. So if you change any one of those in the triangle, if the host is resistant, there's no disease. If the pathogen is avirulent, no disease. But when you have a virulent Pythium and Rhizoctonia and a little take-all and a susceptible winter wheat crop, then we change the environment by keeping the soil cool and wet with straw on it. Remove that straw, and now the soil is warmer and drier, and that reduces the potential for Pythium and Rhizoctonia and take-all to do their damage. And so I did this experiment at Pullman, and I repeated it several times, and I published it in the Soil Biology and Biochemistry Journal, one of my, I think, most clear-cut results. So it turns out that all we were doing when we burned the straw is removing that wet blanket effect of straw laying on the soil surface to keep the soil cool and moist. Remove that straw, and now the pathogens are slowed up. It's not their ideal environment.
So is baling going to provide the same thing?
A little bit, but not enough. And by the way, I tell this whole story in my book that's just come out. And I make a huge point. This is not to advocate for burning. This is to explain scientifically what's happening. How can we, just like fumigation, this is not an advocate for farmers fumigating their soil, but how can we get the same benefit without doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm coming back now to all the things that we worked on, fertilizer placement and soil disturbance and fresh seed and whatnot, all part of the package that we put in place to manage root diseases without burning and without fumigating.
Okay, I'd like to talk about another experiment that you did. You worked on the Steve Matson farm near Bickleton, and you were showing the benefits of a year of fallow. Now, what did you find there?
Well, Steve Matson, I worked on his farm just like I did on Charles Keno's for about 5 years. By the way, in the course of my career, I worked on 3 years or longer on 18 different farms spread out all over the state of Washington and into Oregon and Idaho.
Now, you had a conservation farm that you could work on. Why were you going out to farmers' fields rather than working on the conservation farm 5 miles from WSU?
Well, I worked on that farm, too. In fact, I'd worked every year. I had experiments on the conservation farm, and then after the Cook farm was established, the same there. And a little bit on Spillman Farm, and a lot on the Lind Dryland Research Station. But I also had to go where the problems were, as opposed to trying to create the same thing in an experiment on one of the research farms. But Steve Matson Farm, he's got about 3 to 4 feet of soil, and he was fallowing. And I asked the question, why does he get any benefit from fallow? What can 3 to 4 feet of soil hold in the way of moisture? At the same time, there was a lot of interest. Frank Young and the soil science faculty were looking at, can we add spring wheat to the winter wheat fallow rotation in the low and intermediate rainfall areas, like they're doing in Lincoln County? Can we extend that more into Adams County? And so I got interested in that. And so I thought, I'm going to try an experiment where I set Steve up to rotate winter wheat, spring wheat, like I was talking about a little while ago. Winter wheat, spring wheat, no fallow. And I had my research tool called soil fumigation to have a check. And in the first year, and I repeated this 3 different times with different varieties, with winter wheat after spring wheat in fumigated soil, I got over 50 bushels per acre with no fallow. And What amazed me is that the test weight was also higher by a full pound per bushel. Now, what was happening, what I showed, was that the spring wheat was a host for the take-all disease. And planting winter wheat right into that spring wheat stubble, the take-all fungus grew from the infected crowns on the spring wheat right into the crowns of the winter wheat and produced what I call dryland take-all, which is just the where the tillers are attached to the main stem. It was infected, and that prevented water going to the tops. So what I showed was that the benefit of that year of fallow was for take-all control and not for moisture. Now, I did that in an area with 3 to 4 feet of soil. Would the same thing be true in the rest of the Horsehaven Hills? Would the same thing be true into the dryland part of Adams County? But it was so clear, and these results are also summarized in my book.
I think you'll agree after listening to the two parts of my conversation with Cook that he's an excellent communicator without being flashy. The Joe Friday of research, one might say. You know, just the facts. But from those facts, he tells unique stories. You can find more of his tales in the book he wrote, Untold Stories, which has as its subtitle, 40 Years of Field Research on Root Diseases of Wheat. For the serious student of wheat pathogens, and that should include all farmers and certified crop advisors, the book is recommended reading. For those interested in learning more about the history of farming in the region, meanwhile, the book has details you won't find anywhere else. You can purchase the book at Plant Health International. I'll say it again, Plant Health International. It's Cook's webpage and easily found in a Google search. All that's left is clicking the Buy button. I hope you enjoyed episodes 135 and 136, which I entitled Retired, Not Forgotten, Jim Root Disease Cook, about my conversation with the retired ARS plant pathologist and former interim dean of WSU's College of Agriculture, Human and Natural Resource Sciences. Please reach out to the older generation and help them learn about this podcast. Cook was a part of the lives of many farmers in the region, and I'm sure they'd love to hear from him again. Then join me here again next week for another episode of Wheat All About It.
You think we're simple, you think we're not bright. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.